The reading's from Titus, and it's chapter 2. But as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slave to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women, to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge younger men to be self-controlled. Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. Slaves are to be submissive to their own masters in everything. They are to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering, but showing all good faith, so that in everything they may adjourn the doctrine of God our Saviour. For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age, waiting for our blessed hope that the appearing of the glory of our great God and Saviour Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness, and to purify himself a people for his own possession, who are zealous for good works. Declare these things, exhort and rebuke with all authority, let no one disregard you.
Okay, well, do keep that open. I'm going to use some of the words from the NIV, but I'll try and say where I'm doing that. Last week we looked at the eldership and the role that they play, and I entitled it Straightening Out the Church. I suppose it could be Straightening Out the Church's Direction, and Protecting the Church Against False Teaching. This week it's really Straightening Out the Saints. We're going to look at what we do, really. What's our role? I guess some of you may well have read the book or seen the video of Alexandre Dumas's story, The Count of Monte Cristo. And the story revolves around a chap called Edmond Dantès, and he was betrayed by a lifelong friend, Ferdinand Mondego, and as a result was accused of the crime of treason and was basically jailed. He didn't commit this crime, by the way, and he was imprisoned in an island prison called Chateau d'If, which was quite notorious, and he remained in solitary confinement there for many years. Whipped, actually physically whipped, on the anniversary each year of his imprisonment, just to remind him of the place that he was in. But unknown to him at that time, there was another prisoner, a priest, who was actually digging an escape tunnel, and thinking that he had dug past the boundary wall, this prisoner dug vertically upwards and came through the floor of Edmond's cell, much to the surprise of Edmond. But a great relationship grew up between these two, and the priest basically taught Edmond everything that he knew. Science, even sword fighting, to equip him for the life to come when he was going to be released. Now, apparently, this priest was imprisoned by Napoleon because he had a map to a treasure called the Treasure of Sparta, and Napoleon kept him in prison until he gave this map up, which he never did. Anyway, together, these two decided that they would dig another tunnel, albeit it might take years. They set to work. Unfortunately, one day during the digging, the tunnel collapsed and basically nearly killed the priest. But before he died, he told Edmond to dig into the cell floor of his, take out one of the stones in the cell floor and give him what he found there. And he actually found the map to the Treasure of Sparta, which the priest gave to Edmond, and told him to spend the money wisely. Anyway, the priest died, and through a fairly ingenious messing around with body bags and whatever, Edmond managed to escape the Chateau d'If. He listed in some help, and he went off and found the Treasure of Sparta, which indeed was a treasure of unimaginable value. It's very interesting that Dumas in the story shows an inscription on the prison wall saying that God will give justice. Now, at the time when Edmond's being whipped or when he's in solitary confinement, he used to look at this phrase and think that this phrase and God was actually mocking him, because how could he have justice in this situation? When he escaped, of course, the story leads us to the conclusion that indeed God did give him justice, and everything that he lost, his status and his fiancée, indeed his own life, was restored to him. And it really is. If you've not seen the video or read the book, do. It's a fascinating story. But I guess the question for us this morning as we come into Titus chapter 2 really is, did Edmond Dantès live as Edmond Dantès after he found the treasure of Sparta? Well, the answer is clearly no, he didn't. Otherwise the book wouldn't have been called The Count of Monte Cristo. In fact, he lived like a king after he found the treasure, and he used his wealth basically to expose those that had falsely imprisoned him. And I guess, in a sense, there's some truth there for us, isn't it? Because we have found a treasure of unimaginable value in Christ. And I wonder whether it has changed our life. Are we living as an Edmond Dantès in a prison cell? Or are we living as the Count of Monte Cristo? Well, let's get into chapter 2 and see what Paul is trying to encourage Titus to teach these people about practicing what is being preached. And the first point really is, I think the first point seems to suggest that we should live the Christian life well and be good role models. Verse 1. Teach what is in accord with sound doctrine, the NIV says. We've already seen, haven't we, in chapter 1, verse 9, that the elder has basically two tasks as an elder: to encourage Christians and to refute bad teaching by using sound or healthy doctrine. And it's got to use that doctrine blamelessly, not to bring disgrace upon the church. So Paul encourages him to remember, doesn't he, that sound doctrine does bring results. And I think if you look around this country today, if you look at the evangelical church situation where the gospel is taken seriously and preached well, those churches are generally growing churches and vibrant churches. If you look at the liberal situation, where the gospel is not taken seriously and people basically just say what they want from their own experiences, often those churches are dying. So I think he wants to say to Titus, look, you know, it does bring results if you teach well, if you use sound doctrine. I think we're under pressure today to alter things, aren't we? To water it down or to jazz the message up. But I think it does speak to a modern world, if it's taught correctly. Now, of course, we do need to work hard at trying to understand what the text means, don't we? What it says. And we do need to have to communicate it properly, understand what it means for the modern day. So, as an example, if you look at, say, Romans 14, and you're talking about meat sacrificed to idols, well, there's no way you're going to go into your local Tesco's today and find a shelf that says, you know, meat that's been sacrificed to idols going cheap. So how does that relate to today? Well, you've got to look at the context and understand that it's talking about tripping up a brother by doing something that's inappropriate. So we do need to work hard at things and try and find out what their meanings are for today. But we don't have to alter it. It does speak to people, to the modern world as it stands, without any messing around, so long as it's taught well. But the interesting thing about verse 2 is that the context of this verse is more than just head knowledge. Where it's talking about teach what is in accord with sound doctrine is more than just head knowledge. Listen to what Gordon Fee has to say about this in the New International Bible Commentary. In the pastoral epistles, and that's, if you don't understand what that word is, that's basically the two Timothys and Titus, the metaphor of healthy teaching becomes a thoroughgoing polemic or argument against the diseased false teachers. But the concern of the metaphor is not with the content of doctrine, rather it is with behaviour, love and good works. And that's in direct opposition to the diseased teaching of the heretics that leads to controversies, arrogance, abusiveness and strife. So the context of this word in this passage is that it's, in a sense, doctrine worked out into practical living. There's a very interesting proverb I was looking at in my quiet time the other day that says this, Proverbs 28:18. Now, in the old international version, this proverb used to say, without a vision, where there is no vision, the people perish. But in fact, the NIV gives a much better translation, where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. And basically what that's saying is, where good teaching doesn't happen, where we don't hear from God, then people basically do what they like. The proverb goes on to say, though, that he who keeps the law is blessed. So, good teaching, working it out in practice, is what we need to be about. Now, we saw last week in 1:11, didn't we, that the false teachers seemed to be aiming at households, and not quite sure what they were teaching, but they seemed to be disturbing households. And so Paul seems to be aiming his teaching here at households and the sort of people that may be in the household, not only the household of the church, but the household in, you know, as families. And he starts off looking at older men and women. I think it's fairly obvious why he does that. We need good role models in the church, don't we? I know when I think back in my Christian life, I think of one particular person that helped me because he was just a great role model and showed me what it was to live the Christian life. Now, the word older men, remember we looked at the word elder, presbyteros, or presbyteros. In here it's presbyteros, which is the older man rather than the elder in chapter 2. So it's talking about, as John Stott talks about them, the grey beards. We also saw last week, didn't we, in 1:7, that elders can, if they're not careful, be a bit overbearing. That can be one of the drawbacks of being in a leadership position. But here, it's really talking about the opposite. It's talking about the older man who perhaps is a little bit not feeling that worthy of his position, not wanting to step forward and be a good role model. Now, I well remember my father, well, both my father and my mother, but my father saying to me when he was about 70, that inside he still felt as though he was 20. And he couldn't believe it that when he looked in the mirror, he saw this bald, wrinkled old man looking back at him. I know the feeling well, actually. and it's funny, isn't it? You know, as you get older, I'm in my mid-50s, it's still easy to think that, you know, you need to be looking up to people. Because inside, you still feel quite young. But, you know, there's got to come a time in our lives, hasn't there? Certainly, I mean, look at, I'm probably, me and Barbara and one or two others, probably some of the oldest people in this church. There comes a time when there are no older people than you. And you've got to start taking on board what you are. And you've got to start realising that you are in a position to lead. You've got to become a role model. Even though you feel like a teenager inside, that's no excuse. You've got to become the sort of person that God wants us to be. Now, I think another problem of age is indulgence, isn't it? You know, the mortgage is paid off, the kids are off your hands, life's nice. you know, you can actually do the things that you've never been able to do all your life. So you've got a bit of money, and I've got more money now than I've ever had in my life. And it's easy to indulge yourself, isn't it? It's easy to sort of think, yes, you know, I must do, take all those lost opportunities that I've never had the opportunity to do before. No. Paul says no. Don't do that. Don't act that way. And he uses some words. Be temperate, it says in the NIV. What is it saying this? Self-control, sober-minded. Sober-minded. Be temperate. Moderate how you live. Don't get drunk. Don't do silly things trying to regain your youth. You know, get rid of the gold medallions and the sports cars that are trying to sort of convince you that you can get back, you can relive a life that's been lost. Don't do that. Don't try and impress the money, you know, try and impress people with perhaps the money and the status that you've now gained as an older person in your job. Live properly. In fact, strive for respect. That's the thing that you should be striving for. Dump the rest and think about that. Be self-controlled. We've already seen, haven't we, as we've looked into the letter, that self-control is one of the things that we all really need to take on board seriously. Self-mastery is a better word, I think. It's the key to it all, isn't it? Ephesians 5:18. Be not drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. And that's what we need to do, isn't it? We need to keep in step with the Spirit. And by doing that, self-indulgence will lose its grip on us. And then we have these three beautiful things that you see time and time again, don't we, as marks of Christian, the mature Christian in Paul's letter. Faith, hope, love. If you want to know whether you're a Christian, if you want to know whether you're a growing Christian, then look at those three areas. Are you growing in faith, hope and love? Or has it all died a long time ago? Now it's interesting here that he doesn't use hope, he uses endurance. Because remember, the theme of this letter, or the thrust of this chapter, is the practical outworking of things. And endurance is the practical outworking of hope. It's the thing you have to do. You have to endure, and then hope comes true. We've talked about the word sound and healthy. And so that is the marks of healthy church, faith, hope, love. All right, women, older women, dear me. I'm going to get some flack for this, I know, but don't worry. Right. We need to be clear, don't we, that there are role models for older women that need to be taken seriously. And I think last week we looked, didn't we, that just as morality was more important than qualifications, so it is for the older woman. It's far more important to be reverent than it is to be clever. I hope we see that by the end of this. Now, the word reverent in the NIV, still is the same in the ESV, the word reverent really has with it the connotation of the behaviour befitting a priest, holy living. And it's shown, isn't it, in the way that we respond to people. So the women here are being encouraged not to tear one another down with talk and gossip, and not to drink excessively. Now, I think it's true to say that if you put a group of women together, they don't have very much trouble talking to one another, whereas men want to talk about jobs or don't talk at all. Women do tend to talk fairly freely. But of course, the danger of that is that you can lead off into gossip. And basically, Paul says, don't do that. Excessive drinking. I was trying to wonder why that could be a problem in the context of the day. But I guess we even see it to some extent in our own society. But, you know, there was no tea and coffee, was there? So people would go gather around their friends' houses and they'd probably have, open up a bottle of wine. So I guess social drinking could be an issue for women in that society, as it can be today. But basically, the issue in terms of the modern context is don't fall into worldly patterns of behaviour. That's what it's saying, isn't it? Gossiping and drinking. Instead, think about becoming a role model. And indeed, think about training up some of the younger women. Now, if you're a woman and you're desperate for a teaching role, then this is really the role for you. There's plenty of teaching role situations for women because they are the only people that can do it. It is inappropriate, isn't it, really, for a young minister or even me as a married man to be going into women's groups teaching women. It's just not on. Just in case you're here not married, I think every married woman in the room will know this. I mean, generally, men are stimulated, aroused sexually by vision. That's all. That's all it takes. You know, a woman has to be in a deep, committed relationship. But a man is much more visual. So it's not right, is it, that a man spends all of his time teaching young women. But it is exactly the job for older women to do. Now, I wonder what response you might get if you went out in the street today and you took verses 4 and 5 on a little printed card and you went up to every woman that passed you in the street and you say, hey, what do you think about verses? What do you think? Well, you wouldn't say verses 4. What do you think about this as the way that women should behave towards men? I wonder what sort of response you might get. Maybe there are some women sitting here wondering, well, is this the right response for us anyway as Christian women? Is this what we should be doing? Surely things have moved on. Times have changed. Perhaps we ought to get up to date. Well, if you think like that, I want you to take on board very, very carefully verse 15. Look at verse 15. These then are the things you should teach. It says in the ESV, declare these things. Now, obviously, it's talking about the things that have just been covered in that passage in chapter 2. Declare these things or teach these things. And then look at verse 13. While we wait for Christ's second coming. So you can see here that these are not cultural issues. These are salvation issues. We are to teach these things between Christ's first coming and right the way through until Christ's second coming. So it's wrong to say, you know, we need to bump this and get up to date, get modern in our thinking. No. We don't, because salvation is at stake. And I think really what we need to think through are what has happened to us as because of sin. And I can't remember, I must have been on stewarding or not here, because I can't remember whether Andrew's taught on this, but if he has, forgive me, but I just want to just go back to it in case you're not recognising this as a problem. If you just turn back to Genesis 3 for a moment. And it's chapter 3, verse 16. He says, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now that seems, when you read that verse, that's really basically that women are going to want to be with their husbands. That's going to be their desire. But you have to understand that you've got to read that in the context of 4:7. If you do what is right, this is talking to Cain, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. That word desire is exactly the same word that is used in 3:16. And it doesn't mean I want to be with my husband. It means I want to dominate my husband. Sin is going to dominate me and crush me and control me. That is what it's saying in 4:7. Unless I stand up against it. So the context of 3:16 is saying that because of the fall, woman will now have a desire to dominate her husband, to control him, to manipulate him. So the women's libbers who go on about women wanting equality with men, no, that isn't true. Women want to dominate men because that is part of what the fall is all about. If you think of the roles that God has made, God first or Christ first, then man, then woman, then child, then dog. Okay? If you look at the way our society works, we run around doing everything for our kids. Our kids dominate our lives. Women are often next and the men are under the dog. You laugh, but it's true. I was reading Isaiah the other day, which was very, very interesting, where one of the condemnations at the beginning of Isaiah, of Judah, is that children and women are dominating the society. You read it in Isaiah 3. It's a sign of God's judgment on us rather than a sign of emancipation. So what Paul is saying is that we must get back to the way in which God wants it to be. We must culturally reverse what is happening. We must model what God's design for our lives is all about. And therefore, it's not that a woman is any different to a man. It's not that a woman is less than a man, just as Christ is not less than God. But if we're going to speak to our society, we must be anti-cultural. We must do it in a different way. And that's why he's asking women here, in a sense, to submit to their husbands, just as Christ submits to God the Father. Because it will be different. It will make people think about what's going on and ask questions. We must prove that God's ways work. So we must establish this new order of things. God on top, men, women, children, dog. Okay. And by the way, just as an aside, the world expects Christians to be different. If we're not, the world can't cope with that. The world expects us to be different. And then you can, when we are different, you can apply 1 Peter 3:15. We can tell them why we're different. We can tell them about the hope that is in us that is making us different. Okay, young men. What verse are we on here? 6. I don't think self-control is a word that defines young people today. I can think of many that do, but it certainly isn't that. But what Paul is asking is, again, we need to be countercultural in the way young people are behaving if we're going to make any impact in the world at all. So when you're going out with your mates and you want to get the people saying, oh, let's get drunk, you say, no, I don't want to get drunk. Or let's sleep with our girlfriends. No, I don't want to sleep with my girlfriend. It takes guts, doesn't it, to be different. It takes guts to go against your culture. I don't know if any of you have seen the film Men of Honor. It's a great film. If you haven't seen it, think about it. It's about a diver, Carl Brashear, who was the first black deep sea diver for the Navy. And the story is basically about how against all the odds, he became this deep sea diver. No black man had ever graduated from this diving school in the Navy, and he took enormous flack off of these people. In fact, Billy Sunday, who is the in reality didn't exist. I looked all this up on the internet, so I knew a bit about him. But Robert De Niro, who plays Billy Sunday, is a sort of a conglomeration of all the people that hated Carl Bashir, and he's put them all together in this one character. But in 1954, he passed the US Navy ship salvage exam. And then in January 1966, after going through all this and becoming a deep sea diver, he lost his leg in an accident. They were trying to recover some nuclear bombs that had fallen into the ocean because of an aircraft crash, and one of the straps broke on while they were recovering this bomb and tore his leg off. Now, you'd think he'd give up, wouldn't you? You would think he would give up. He's taken years of flak for being a black man. You'd think he'd now... No, he didn't. He became the first black one-legged deep sea diver. Sounds incredible, but it's true. It's true. But the thing he most wanted was the coveted master diver. And he got it. Now, it seems to me, you know, as a young person, this is what you've got to become, haven't you? You've got to have this single-mindedness and want these things badly, because it's only in wanting them and asking God to help you that you will actually achieve this great thing. But I think it's true in the Bible, isn't it, that we're never encouraged in the Bible to do something that we can't actually do. So when Paul says to young people, be self-controlled, it's not something beyond the realms of possibility. It is achievable. Okay. And of course, Titus himself, if you look at 15b, is a young man, isn't he? So Paul is really saying this to Titus as a young man. Let me just read you 1 Timothy 4:12. This is Timothy. Don't let anyone look down on you because you are young, but set an example for the believers in speech, in love, in life, in faith, and in purity. So Timothy was a young man, just like Titus, who was a young man. And Paul says at the end, doesn't he, 15b, don't let anybody despise you. Well, presumably he's saying that because he's young. But he, in verse 7, he encourages him to do two things, doesn't he? Be a good role model to the young people. You know, be a Carl Bashir. Be that sort of person. And be a good teacher. And how is he to do this? Well, integrity. Live out what you preach. Don't say one thing and do another. Seriousness. You know, I think we've reached a stage with our young people now where, not in this church, but I think sometimes we feel as though we can't do anything with young people in a serious way, that unless it's jokey and funny, that young people aren't going to listen. I don't think that's true, actually. I think if we approach young people in an adult way and treat them with an adult intent, we can get an adult response. So we don't have to live our lives in jokes and flippancy all the time. So don't act like a child to win children. You don't have to do that. You can say serious things and they can take it. And of course, sound doctrine is the key. We come back to this again and again and again, isn't it? Be healthy in the way that you teach, because sound doctrine gives life. And if you do all those things, you won't be criticised, as it says in at the end of verse 8. All right, slaves. I suppose you could say that slaves were a part of the family life in those days. I know the 19th century reformers spent a great deal of time, Wilberforce and Shaftesbury, and these characters abolishing slavery, rightly so. It's interesting how the Bible doesn't say an awful lot about it, but tends to accept it as part of life in those days. But clearly we've got exactly the same thing. Be countercultural. you know, you can imagine, can't you? If you're a slave, you probably resent working for the person that you're a slave to. And you probably try and claw back every conceivable thing that you can. Stealing, and if you can get a cheeky word in to just show that, you know, you're not crushed underfoot, then you'll be cheeky. But Paul says, no, don't. Don't do that. Don't steal. Don't talk back. In fact, not only don't do those things, but be proactive. Try to please. Verse 9. Be a trustworthy person instead of somebody who's always got to be watched. And then when they ask you, well, why are you like this? You know, all the other slaves aren't like this. Why are you like this? You're the first one I've had who's actually tried to do me some good. Then you tell them why. I'm doing this because I love Christ. All right, so that's the first part. Second part, salvation of all men is the issue, verses 11 to 15. Salvation of all men is the issue. That's what we're talking about here. Now, if you've read much of Paul's letters and Ephesians and all these, you'll see that normally Paul starts off by doctrine, why we do things, and then he finishes with application, what we do. But it's true in Titus, you'll see that every chapter is exactly that, the other way around. And we get another four. You don't get it in either of these versions, but but verse 3 often starts with a 4 in some versions. In the NIV, it's at one time. Sorry, I beg your pardon. What am I talking about? In verse 11, we do start with a 4. I'm looking at chapter 3. What is it in 2 here? Yeah, no, there is a 4. Yeah. So verse 11, where we get a break between the split between doctrine and application, we see another 4, as we did in the first chapter. And it's at verse 11. 4. So why be like this? Why be elders? Why be holy women, loving wives and good mothers, self-controlled young people, obedient slaves? When clearly going against the culture, being anti-culture, is going to be costly and tough. Well, because God bothered for us. That's what verse 11 is about, isn't it? Grace began in the heart of God. From the beginning of time, it was there. But he showed the reality of grace by sending Christ into the world. And that's the word that's used, isn't it? Appeared. In verse 11, appeared. What is it in here? Appeared. The grace of God appeared. Grace became visible. It's interesting, the word actually is epiphany. That was the first epiphany of God. I first remember that word in looking at the video Hook. Have you seen that, when Captain Hook talks about having an epiphany? Doesn't matter. But anyway, technical word, the grace of God appeared. God bothered for us, didn't he? Grace became visible. Now, on the 30th of June, 1859, if you've ever done the Christianity Explained rather than the Christianity Explored course, you may have heard about Blondin, who put a tightrope across the Niagara River, and he crossed it. He was a stuntman, tightrope walker. He crossed it on a bicycle. He walked blindfolded across it. He cooked an omelette in the middle of the tightrope. He walked across it with his hands and feet manacled. And one time he announced to the press that he was going to walk across this tightrope pushing a wheelbarrow. And he asked them, do you think I could push a man across this tightrope? A man sitting in the wheelbarrow. And one of the reporters said to Blondin, you are the greatest stuntman alive. Indeed, you could do that. So Blondin said to him, you get in the wheelbarrow. Now, there's a great difference, isn't there, between saying that Christ makes grace visible. There's a great difference between saying that and believing it. Because if you believe it, basically what he's saying is you make it visible because grace has affected your life. Do I see grace visible in you by what Christ has done? And that's really what this section is about, isn't it? Christ makes grace visible for all to see. But does it make it visible in us? That is the question. Do our actions make grace visible? How do we help people see it? And according to verse 12 and 13, grace should have two effects. We should be able to be saying, growing in our ability to say no to ungodliness and yes to godliness. No to ungodliness and yes to godliness. Verses 12 and 13. You know, godly living is not just a recreational habit for the few keenies among us. It's something that Paul wants us all to take seriously. And then look at verse 13. We've already mentioned this verse. This is the second epiphany, the second appearing. So we're supposed to say no to ungodliness and yes to godly living in the period between the first epiphany and the second epiphany. And in fact, in this present age, which is what the definition of this present age is, isn't it? Between the two appearings of Christ. So we're to live like this all the time. Basically, that's what it's saying. And we're why? Well, because we've been redeemed. Look at verse 14. We've been redeemed. That's what we've been bought for. Bought back. This idea of the pawn shop and you go and redeem something. You buy it back. We've been redeemed for this purpose. Now remember one very important point. Israel was brought into being for this purpose. An insignificant nation were brought into being to honour God, and they failed to do it and brought judgment upon themselves. But look at this, look at verse 14. We won't fail to do that if we're Christians. Because if the Spirit is living in us, then Christ has given himself. Look at the three words he uses. Gave, redeem, purify. He's given himself, he's redeemed us, and he's purifying us. So we shouldn't be a people who fail. We should be a people fit for a king, it says in verse 14. To do his work. So Paul finishes the chapter where he started. Teach people. This is what God is doing. Teach them this is what God is doing. And we need to get on board with it, otherwise we're going to get left behind. So just in summary, two appearings, Christ's birth, Christ's second coming, define the present days. We are to live between these two epiphanies as changed people, motivated by his grace. Grace, God's riches at Christ's expense. Do you remember that acronym? Poured out on us at his first coming and will be revealed to us fully in his second coming when we will be made princes of his kingdom. And the question really that confronts us all this morning is, have these treasures changed your life?